Hello, August. Huh.
Hey, Pete. It's that time again where we talk about the CRA, isn't it?
It is. Welcome to the second episode of Ode to Resilience, our podcast about the EU Cyber Resilience Act. My name is Pete De Vare. I'm an engineer, I'm a CRA consultant, and I'm a member of the Commission's expert group on the CRA. How about you, August?
Hi, my name is August Bornique. I am an attorney by profession, and I am currently a special rapporteur on CRA standardization, as well as a consultant for CRA compliance.
And August, what do we want to talk about today?
I've been hearing a lot about this supply chain thing, and my take on it is that last time we mentioned a little bit how the CRA had these two kind of repeated goals, or yeah, we'll call them goals, which are product security and market transparency. Digital products sold in the European Union should be secure, and you should know what you're buying and how secure it is and what it's for and all that. Mm-hmm. But I think there's another one in there. I think there's one in there that's maybe not as explicitly stated, but comes up quite a bit if you go through the text of the CRA, which is supply chain resilience, supply chain security. And what does that mean, Pete? What does supply chain security in the context of digital products within the EU and within the CRA, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
Would be where we'd have to start.
So in the pre-discussion, we actually thought about this for a bit and listed all of the various supply chain interactions that we see, or all of the actors and directions in which there are supply chain obligations in the CRA. And we found basically three main categories. There's the upstream obligations, which are things like manufacturers need to do component due diligence, they need to do vulnerability handling, they need to upstream vulnerabilities, they need to look specifically, this is part of the components, but it's worth mentioning explicit because it's so important, they need to take care of the free and open source software components that they integrate into their products. And there are various considerations or obligations regarding RDPS, so cloud services that support product functionality. These are all upstream. Then there's the downstream obligations with regards to providing information on how to securely use a product, either to the end users of the product, or if the product is to be integrated, to whoever is integrating the product into some other product or system. And there's the need, also part of vulnerability handling, to provide security advisory, so basically keep downstream users of your product informed about security, I'll call them incidents, all security relevant aspects of your product that are dynamic. And then there's some other obligations that you don't hear that much, or that you don't hear that much about, because usually when we're talking about the CRA, we're always talking about manufacturers. But there's actually also obligations for distributors and importers, where they need to verify that the products that they're selling, that they come with certain artifacts that ensure CRA compliance.
So yeah, those are the requirements. I think for me, a couple definitions that I think are worth going over are: what do we mean by upstream? What do we mean by downstream?
Yeah.
And what do we mean by component? And these are fairly simple. Think of a river, upstream, the source, all the little junk that it collects as it flows downstream to eventually the consumer. And all the way along, the product, the components, which are in this case frequently software or just code or a library, or could be a physical component if you're producing a physical product like a router or a laptop or something like that. All the wiring, all the chips, all those are components as well. But because of the nature of the CRA, a lot of what we're talking about are software components, and a lot of those are going to be open source. A lot of those are going to be just a commonly used chunk of code or something like that.
Yeah.
We're not talking about stuff that is bundled on the product or bundled with the product. But that is also an interesting discussion that we won't get into today.
When a manufacturer is building a product, they take a bunch of stuff from their upstream providers. They put that into the product. They do some additional development or integration around those components that they grab from their upstream providers. They put it in the product. That's called upstream. And then they provide that product to someone else who then does something with it. And everybody that's past the manufacturer in that supply chain is downstream. Everyone that's before the manufacturer in the supply stream is upstream.
Yeah, and I think another thing on component that's worth mentioning, that when we talk about component, we're using it generally in the way the CRA uses it, which is to say to talk about third-party components. Mm-hmm. It's entirely, everything is made up of components. There are large numbers of components within every digital product. When we're talking about components, we're generally not talking about first-party manufacturer-produced components. We're talking about components that you got from somewhere else. I won't even say bought, but third-party components. So a lot of times when people are talking CRA, they'll say component, and it can be confusing if you're a manufacturer because I have all sorts of components. I make them here at my factory. Do I have to do this to every single one of them? No, because the requirements are upstreaming, downstream requirements, and all that are about third-party components almost entirely.
Yeah.
And this is different.
That point that you bring up, that's quite an interesting point as well, because I've had discussions about that with some manufacturers, where it's very clear that for third-party components, you have these due diligence obligations. So you need to verify that the component is sufficiently secure for the use case in which you're using it. And the component does not compromise the security of your product, so of the manufacturer's product. But if you're a manufacturer, especially if you're a larger organization, there will be a lot of components that you potentially put in your products, which you obtain from other parts of the organization. And within large organizations, parts of the same organization will even often refer to each other as customers and suppliers. And it's an interesting question. When you have such a setup, so when you have a larger organization that has internal components that are only supplied internally, to what extent do the full CRA obligations apply? And to what extent do only the due diligence obligations apply? I have an opinion about this. But I don't think...
I do too.
I think we probably have the same opinion.
We probably do.
But it's not a matter that is entirely settled.
It's a complex... It's its own complex matter.
Do you want to give your opinion on this?
I mean, when do I not want to give my opinion, Pete? Do you want to give yours?
I'll go after you.
All right. I believe that in general with components, and not just internal suppliers, internal components, first-party components, but in general with components... The primary concern for any manufacturer is, does the final product, because the CRA is a product regulation, does the final product meet the essential cybersecurity requirements? So to some extent, the amount of due diligence that you produce on the, that you perform on those products is going to very much resemble testing the actual final product itself and making sure that it is compliant. So as much as we talk about components, there are certain special things you have to do. You do need to make sure they're fit for purpose. You do need to document that. But if you're doing that with internal components, you're really just testing the product. You're really just documenting that those essential requirements are met by the product, which is much like what you're doing with third-party component. But since you don't own the component, you don't know all its manufacturing processes, et cetera, in some ways you have to do maybe a little less. That would be my take.
So... Are you saying, because I'm not sure I fully understood this, are you saying that for a manufacturer, if you're using a first-party component, so a component that comes from the same larger organization, that the obligations are the same as for third-party components, or that the obligations are more stringent than for third-party components?
I'm not saying they're the same. Yeah. What I'm saying is that the process you're going to engage in is similar, because... The difference is that with a third-party component, a lot of the time, not always, obviously open-source components are a particular concern here, you are not going to have a C mark on that internal component because it's not being placed on the market separately. So there's no reason for it to go through its own CRA assessment. But you will still need to make sure that when you integrate it, it doesn't make trouble for your product as a whole. The product that is going on the market needs to meet those essential cybersecurity requirements. Obviously, if that component has vulnerabilities in it that get in the way with that, you need to mitigate those. Whereas if it's a third-party component and you have the documentation, you have a C mark on it, in many cases, that will probably be enough. Obviously, when you test your full product put together and it creates problems, once again, you're going to have to look to that component and maybe swap it out for something better if it's causing the problem. But in both cases, the focus for testing, the focus for making sure you meet your security requirements is not on the component itself. It is on the product as a whole. And so any component process that you do is going to be filtered through that testing and that securing and the compliance for the product as a whole. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Does that make more sense?
It does, but I'm not sure I fully agree, because my stance was going to be that if you are a manufacturer and you sell a product, you have full security development lifecycle obligations for that product. And so the model that I have in my head is you're a manufacturer, you sell a product, you have full SDL obligations, so SDL security development lifecycle obligations for that product. But when there are components in that product that you don't develop yourself, then instead of having to do that full SDL, you can show that you have done your due diligence obligations on your component. And as also the guidance, the draft commission guidance suggests, that due diligence is going to, for a large extent, rely on the risk assessment of your hosting product, so the product that contains the component, where you need to think, okay, what are the important security products of that component? But you don't necessarily need to go and do testing, et cetera, of that component. Whereas in the, if you need to follow an SDL, that SDL would likely require you to do more. And the way I see it is that when you're a manufacturer, it doesn't really matter how you internally structure your organization. When there is content in that product that you as a manufacturer have developed in-house, then you have the full SDL obligations under the CRA, regardless of what your internal structure is and regardless of whether the product team bought this from a platform team or whether they wrote it themselves.
I agree with that. I just think the emphasis I'm trying to make is a little bit more on sort of what your obligations are towards your internal products and or your internal component, internally produced components. And that ultimately, if you're using, say, the same, I don't know, graphics card in a tablet that you produce and a laptop you produce and a public kiosk display thing that you make, each of those is a different product. Mm-hmm. And each of those could potentially have different requirements. Mm-hmm. So rather than go in from the beginning and say, okay, I'm CE marking my internal graphics card, not that I suspect there'd be a huge number of risks associated with that, you have to look at each one of those individual products that you've made and that you're putting this card into, and you need to make sure that it is secure for its use case. Mm-hmm. And whereas if you're buying components from someone else, it's going to be harder to do that because you do not have the same insight into that component. You're not making it. You don't know what its secure development lifecycle really looks like. Yeah, part of that due diligence is going to be maybe getting a contract with the people providing it that says we do things this way. But at the end of the day, what you end up with is an individual product that you have a component in that is itself CE marked, that you have done an assessment on. And whether you use a third party or a first party component, much of that assessment is going to look very similar. And you're going to say, we use this graphics card or this component because this and this, and in this context, it's secure. Mm-hmm. And if it has security issues itself in the abstract, those have been mitigated this way, that way, or however it works for that product.
What's quite interesting there is that when you're integrating a third-party component, assuming for a moment that it's a component that's placed on the market in the EU, then, and assuming that we're past the transition period for CRA entry into effect, then that component will be CE marked, and it will come with, for example, the integration guidance that as an integrator should help you to, or should tell you how to integrate that component securely. When you're using an internal component that's not placed on the market, that in practice will often not be the case. At least currently, many organizations are fairly sloppy with this. And therefore, I find it interesting when you're saying that internal component that's not something that is CE marked, that has undergone conformity assessments, or therefore, I'm not sure if I followed your train of thought completely, but you seem to be suggesting therefore you need a different approach or maybe a more lightweight approach.
A more rigorous approach.
A more rigorous approach.
Because, as you say, you don't really have any... It's entirely your responsibility. Yeah. It's always your responsibility as a component of your product. But you may not know as much about its fitness or purpose. But you'll have better access to knowing that, presumably, because you can walk across to the next department and say, hey, I need all your technical documentation. Yeah. You need to... But I do think one of the things that colors my opinion is that you're saying third-party components are going to be CE-marked. And this is true for commercial components. But remember... So much software, so many software components these days are open source. And a large number of them are not commercial open source. A large number of commercial products, simply full products even effectively, or projects, I should say, and integrate them. And that becomes the product they're selling. And the integrated open source project may have no CRA requirements at all. It doesn't have to do an assessment. So in a way, that third party project component, when it's integrated, it's much like a first party component because you have the source code, but you don't have any CE mark. You don't have a contract, probably. Yeah. All you have is the thing itself. So I think that there is going to be a lot of interplay there between what the due diligence on a third-party component is, if it's open source or even if it's closed source, versus what you have to do to check your own. It's very gray and it's very nebulous. And what that due diligence is under Article 13.5 of the CRA is itself at this point pretty nebulous. So I think we're basically on the same page. Yeah. It's just where we're placing our emphasis.
So the point you just made about free and open source software is super interesting, and I want to jump back to that. But before, I want to finish the previous thought, where what I am suggesting to customers or clients right now is that those internal components that are reusables, that they basically treat those in the same way as if they were products that they were selling on the market. So they go through a lot of the similar machinery that they would have to go through if they would want a CE mark, which means that they do a risk assessment, they do risk communication, they create that integration guidance. They, of course, they don't do a formal CE conformity assessment, but basically they do all of the same things. And then they provide that information, so that technical documentation and that user documentation, to the other teams in the organization that are integrating that component, for either including this, the technical documentation of this module into the technical documentation of the final product, but also so that the products that are integrating the components, they know what risks are associated with that component. And when the product level risk assessment is done, they don't need to completely expand that component again and look for, let's say that there's 10 products that integrate that same component. You don't need to have 10 independent risk assessments that consider all of the various aspects of that component. And so it's basically a way
to create level of abstraction. But you're going to need 10 individual risk assessments for those products, those 10 different products.
Yeah, but let's say that those components, that there is a very important security asset. Let's say that there's an important key that's in that component. Then you don't need to 10 times think of, okay, what assets do I have in that component? Instead, you can consider that component as a black box, which has well-defined security interfaces, where it says that, hey, maybe in this way you need to provide a secure key storage mechanism to this component, or maybe this component integrates secure key storage, but it's really only intended to be used in these environments. And then you get, with that component, you get a list of what are the intended operational environments and what is the foreseen product security context for that component, and then also what are the risks that that internal integrator still needs to deal with when they're using that component.
Yeah, and I think that'd be a very good way of handling it. I think you're correct there. My impression would be that the technical documentation that you do producing the component, checking the component, is something that you pass on to the people producing the final product.
Yeah,
it's going to probably go directly into their technical documentation, but they're going to do another layer of assessment on top of that, which is to say they're going to show that the product itself is, say, interacting with it in the right way.
Yeah, correct.
Providing the right kind of keys, and that it is fit for purpose for that particular product's use case. So yeah, we are absolutely saying the same thing. I'm just emphasizing the finality of the real assessment, which is the one that's on the product you're putting on the market, was you're talking about the internal process of getting there.
Yeah.
And yeah, you got to do both. That's the thing, right? And you're going to help me, you're going to make your final assessment much easier the more you do on the component and making sure it's appropriate and secure. Mm-hmm. If you just hand someone something, just say, hey, try this. That's not very nice to your internal buyers.
But let's jump to that other point that you're making. Yes. I want to tie it in to actually third-party components as well, or third-party hardware components, commercial components, where you were saying that if you're integrating a free and open source project that does not provide you with any conformity statements to the CRA, and because that's not an obligation, that code you basically have to treat very similarly as if it were first-party code that you wrote yourself. And yep. I'm not sure that I agree with that, but we can get to that in a second. But I want to draw the parallel to what would happen when you're integrating components which are not CE marked, which can happen when you're a manufacturer. And I'm a hardware guy, so I tend to think about hardware, but the same can be true for software. If you're buying a hardware component in, let's say, Taiwan, and then you're integrating that into your product in Taiwan, because that's where your manufacturing plant is, or maybe, I'm not sure how this sits exactly legally, you are yourself importing that product into the EU for use in your own production, then it's perfectly legal and possible to buy such a component that you will integrate into your final product that does not have a CE mark. And does that then mean, do you think that then means that you basically need to treat that component in the same way as if it were a first party component?
I think to the extent that you can treat it that way, the difference I would think, and this goes to open source as well, and I think it creates an issue for FOSS projects, a potential issue for FOSS projects that it really is going to fall on the manufacturers. But I think where the liability lives, where the risk lives, is with the person integrating the component, especially for FOSS components. The product you bought that's not CRA compliant, you may place certain requirements on your supplier. Say, hey, I need all your technical documentation. I need to look at the code. I need you to run the following tests and give me the information on it so that I can have those for my final product's technical documentation to show that I did due diligence. And that's the thing about due diligence. There's the CRA indicates a few places, I think recital 30 something, what it might look like. The guidance goes over it a little bit in another context, but it's pretty nebulous still. And what it looks like is looking for a CE mark, looking at documentation, maybe that's enough, but then also it can go as far as to testing directly on that component or testing on that component as it's included in the product. It really can be anything. I wouldn't say it can be nothing, but it can be almost anything. And I think the less you know about the component you're integrating, whether that's FOSS or an overseas supplier or an internal supplier or whatever, the more you know about it, the easier it is to show compliance. The less you know about it, the more testing you're going to have to do, the more you're going to have to muck around with it. And that puts a lot of pressure on component suppliers. We've already seen integrators of FOSS components reach out to these FOSS projects and say, hey, you need to comply with the CRA. You need to give us an SBOM. You need to test, show us that you meet these tests. None of that's true. But the manufacturer that is the partner of this FOSS project doesn't want to do that, maybe can't do that, and is trying to bully or trick or convince the FOSS project that it's better off if it does some of this compliance work. And that's going to be really hard, because I think one of the key things about open source to understand is that a lot of people get involved in open source because they really like coding, they like solving the problems, they like doing the programming. From what I can tell, there's very few people that get the same joy about doing free compliance work.
Yeah.
And so I suspect there's going to be some money changing hands somewhere.
Yeah.
And who is going to do that compliance for these open source projects?
So there, I'll briefly mention it, but then I want to jump to another related topic, because I think I'll briefly mention right now is really an entire episode on its own, and we should have a guest for that. That is that the CRA actually foresees a mechanism that would allow or that could support or allow commercial players to support open source projects with that compliance work. So that's the security attestation mechanism. Do you know the article by heart, August?
I don't. I steer clear of attestations.
Okay, there's...
I mean, the standards don't have to care that much about attestations and SBOMs. That's because they're not essential cybersecurity requirements of Annex 1, Article 1, which is what I know most.
There's,
you know.
I looked it up. It's Article 25, security attestation of free and open source software that's dealing with this. There's a lot of effort going on currently in trying to figure out how such a security attestation for free and open source software could look like in practice. Again, that's a topic for a different time. What I want to highlight, though, is that when you were talking before about these due diligence obligations for the non-CE marked components, that there is a huge difference between hardware components and software components. Because when you're dealing with hardware components, for most of your hardware components, it's fairly clear what that hardware component does. And in many cases, for the vast majority of products, there is going to be only a very small number of hardware components in your product that pose any meaningful cybersecurity risk. When you have a product, and even when it connects to the internet and you have a microcontroller which stores a private key, then for most products, the due diligence for that microcontroller is probably going to be fairly easy. If you can say that microcontroller is developed by a very reputable manufacturer, potentially they already have some certification on the crypto module in there, then most products, they will have such a low risk level that doesn't really matter, or the risks involved in that are pretty small. There are going to be many other components that technically fall under the CRA, but which for the security of most products that integrate them are going to be largely irrelevant. I'm going to say something like an LCD display driver or a flash memory chip. And the real security risk for most products associated with this is going to be near zero. And that's quite different from software components, where software components, partially because they have such a tremendous amount of complexity, and also because they are so closely integrated into your system and there's so little isolation between that software component that you integrate and then the software that you write yourself or potential other software components that you integrate, it could be that even a software component that seems fairly meaningless can actually be extremely security relevant if there would be a vulnerability in it. A great example would be something like Log4j, right, where you have a logging library where you would think, okay, logging, that's not really super exposed. If logging is compromised, that is probably not the biggest deal. But then it turns out that if there is a vulnerability in that logging library, actually so many systems can be so incredibly vulnerable. Similarly, we had the very famous XZ attack, which was an attack against the compression library, where you would think a compression library, how bad can that be? Compression is not a security critical function, you would think. But then it turns out that by putting a supply chain vulnerability into that XZ library, it was actually possible to backdoor, I don't know the exact number, but I'm just going to say most of the servers on the internet. And so it shows how there really is not such a thing as an unimportant software component, not in a product that is connected to the internet.
I'm totally in agreement here. I do note that we've spent a lot of time on this part of due diligence and this part of supply chain on what I would consider Article 13.5 of the CRA's due diligence requirements for the integration of components. That's not the end of supply chain issues for the CRA, though. It's probably one of the more important and certainly one of the most, the ones that needs to be most rigorously handled. Mm-hmm. And where there's a lot of these very tricky questions. But I think there's plenty of other areas that we should just go over quickly if we're going to talk about supply chain.
Yeah, let's do it.
It's an entire ecosystem, right? It's an entire ecosystem. It's a market ecosystem as well. It's a lot of ecosystems. Mm-hmm. It's a regular Amazonian rainforest of supply chain. So we've got those upstreaming requirements in 13.6, which I have a lot of thoughts on.
So what does it say?
Can I say what those thoughts are without going off into the weeds about them? Probably.
Let's try.
So Article 13.6 is a requirement that if you're a manufacturer and you're using components in your product and you discover a vulnerability in one of those components, you need to report that vulnerability. And this is whether it's a commercial component or an open source component. And it gets tricky when it comes to open source components for various reasons, but mostly because you don't necessarily know whose component it is some of the time. But you need to report it upstream. You need to try to fix it to make your own product secure again, if nothing else. Well, you can mitigate it as well. You could swap it for a different component that doesn't have a security vulnerability in it. But you need to upstream that fix, whether you document, hey, we stopped using your library, we switched to this other one, or this is the patch we have. Here it is. And so that's a pretty fascinating requirement. It's one that definitely can help open source projects. I think it also is a lot more complex than it might appear at first glance, because it does mean having a really good amount of insight into what components you're using and who makes them and where they're coming from. In order to do that, particularly when you look at the components within those components, you're looking at what the SBOM is. And this is a phrase that you hear a lot in CRA. Basically, the list of parts. It's a parts list for your product, which can get very complex very fast.
Yeah.
I think there is...
This is a point which I find so important, what you were just mentioning, is that this knowing what is in your product and actually actively knowing it, right, and managing it, because when you hear people talk about the CRA and the obligations, you hear a lot about SBOMs and vulnerability handling. But SBOMs and vulnerability handling is something very reactive, right? So you have a product, you create an SBOM of it, and then you do CVE monitoring. And when a CVE comes up, then you go and you look at, okay, what is this CVE? What is this vulnerability? Does it even really affect my product, or is there some reason why it's not relevant for my product? So it's very reactive, and it doesn't actually require you as a manufacturer to be very aware of what is in your product. As long as it's somewhere in this giant machine-readable SBOM file, that's enough for the vulnerability handling obligations, or for at least the vulnerability monitoring obligations. However, when you're talking about due diligence, this is really a proactive obligation, where you as a manufacturer, you need to be able to justify for each single component that's in your product why that component does not compromise the security of your product. So that means that it's not enough to just have an SBOM file that you never looked at and just look at it reactively when a new vulnerability comes in, but you really need to look proactively at the structure of your product and whether that structure and those components in your product are justifiable. Maybe at some point we'll have automated tools for that as well, but we don't have that currently.
You know, plenty of people are working on them.
Yeah. But really that distinction between the reactiveness of vulnerability monitoring and the proactiveness of component due diligence, I think that's a very important distinction.
Which gets to another interesting thing about 13.6 and the upstreaming requirement. And that is that it does not say known exploited vulnerabilities. I believe it simply says vulnerabilities. Now, those have to be known, obviously. You have to know it's there to find it and fix it. But it is a much broader category than the ones you have to report to ANISA.
That is true.
Now, I don't know how that's going to play out as the law becomes more mature and how much trouble people are going to get in for potentially not upstreaming fixes. Mm-hmm. But the wording is there, and the wording seems very broad and makes this a very important requirement.
And this is a question where me, as the engineer, I become curious and I like asking a lawyer, right? When you have a legal text and you see that in this case, it uses this specific wording, is the distinction relevant between whether the adjective exploitable is not in front of vulnerability there is an intended way of stating this in the law? And therefore is relevant, or this is just unintended sloppiness, so to say. And if it is unintended sloppiness, is that then relevant or is it not relevant that it is written in that specific way in the law?
I'm a US lawyer, so this is not my particular statutory comfort zone, But I have also read the CRA way too many times. My understanding is that it does matter, but whether it ultimately matters in the courts or how the CRA is enforced to the MSAs is going to be the traditional lawyer answer of it depends. I think reading the text, facially, the text is pretty clear. There's a difference between a known exploited vulnerability, a known exploitable vulnerability, and a vulnerability. These are all very different. I think it's implied that the vulnerability in 13.6 is known because you can't tell people about things that you don't know about.
Yeah, it's also upon identifying a vulnerability. So
right, upon identifying. Yeah. I was just about to look it up myself. But yeah, but other than that, the implication there seems very clear. Whether the courts and the MSAs will enforce that as strictly as the wording there seems to indicate, I don't think we'll know for 5-10 years.
It's a very difficult thing to enforce, right?
Right.
Because it's not,
I suppose, it's not very the nightmare scenario. Yeah. The parade of horribles would be there's a commonly used open source component, and some company discovers a vulnerability in it, fixes that vulnerability, does not upstream it, has no reason for not upstreaming it, and then something terrible happens with that vulnerability. It gets widely exploited. Mm-hmm. Millions of Europeans' vacation pictures are shared on the dark web. People are made fun of in their homes. The public is enraged. The MSAs are looking for someone to blame. I would not want to be the company that had the fix for that vulnerability 6 months before this whole situation happened. Because I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to be struck by lightning either. And I don't know what the chances are, which is more likely. But again, you know, there's ways you can imagine this playing out that would be pretty bad for someone.
In practice, the MSA would still have to find out that the manufacturer knew about this, right? Which, of course, is not impossible. But it's not a trivial thing for an MSA to find out and enforce either. There's probably an element of luck involved there.
Yeah, and I do think when I make some sort of parade of horribles like that, I think it's worth noting that my suspicion is that most companies are going to the degree they try to comply with the CRA at all, which is something you really should do, they're going to try to do a good job. I when I talk to people, when I talk to manufacturers, when I talk to open source projects, when I talk to open source stewards, most people just want to know how to do this, not how to get around it, not how not to do it. They want to know, what do I do to be secure, to be safe, as opposed to, you know, how can I be a scofflaw more effectively?
I see that a bit more, Mick. So you definitely have those companies and product teams that want to build better, more secure products. And there are some product teams are also glad that they're finally getting an excuse, so to say, as why to put resources against that. There's also those companies that just want to get the CE mark and they want to do that with as little hassle as possible. It's not to say that it's not smart to always make sure that you get to your CRA conformity as efficiently as possible. You don't have to, whatever you do with your product, you should make sure that what you do makes sense and that you do it in an efficient way. But there's a difference between trying to efficiently secure your product and trying to really just do absolute bare minimum to get the check marks for the CRA. And in my view, that later thing is actually basically not possible because the CRA just says you need to take the security of your product seriously. And if you are trying to do the absolute bare minimum and you don't actually want to take the security of your product seriously, then you're almost by definition not CRA compliant. Of course, with MSAs and such, everything is a bit more nuanced, but it's against the spirit of the CRA at least.
And enforcement is always going to be an issue. How many enforcement actions can all the MSAs in Europe conduct each year? Yeah. I don't think it's nearly as many as there are products, right? Yeah. But I do want to mention that when we talk about these requirements that like Pete has just, I think, quite eloquently described, these include your due diligence to your third-party components or to your first-party, or to components in general. They include your integration. They include your supply chain issues. And we've talked a little bit about the upstream. Did you want to mention the downstream stuff really quickly?
Yeah. So I think we implicitly covered the downstream stuff. There is the integration guidance. So this, you have to describe how somebody who uses your product, either as an end user or as an integrator, how they can do so in a secure manner. We discussed that, I believe, quite at length when we're talking about the internal components, etc. And then there's the security advisories, which are very closely related to vulnerability handling, where when you find a vulnerability in your component, you need to patch that vulnerability, if possible, through a software update. That's going to be the primary mechanism. And then when you do that, or also when you cannot do that, you need to make sure that the right information flows to the users of your product so that they know what to do to make that product secure again. So that can either be install the software update, or it can be careful when you do this or that with the product.
And again, that's for products, though. That's for CR things that must be CRA compliant.
Yeah, correct.
Whether it's a component that is also a product or a product that contains components.
Yeah.
Did we want to talk about the funny little thing we found when we were looking at the phrase supply chain in the CRA, which is to say the other implication of supply chain that is, you know, kind of hot off the presses, a little bit under focused on.
Yep.
And this is something that we could have a whole discussion on, and we probably will, because it ties distinctly into technological sovereignty, digital sovereignty.
Yeah.
That is something that the CRA is looking at when it comes to supply chain.
Should we start by saying how many mentions of NIS2 there are in the CRA? Do you recall the number, August?
There are 20. The supply chain is mentioned 20 times.
And how many times is NIS2
and
mentioned?
And I can't remember. NS2 is mentioned about half the time supply chain is mentioned. Well, NS2 is mentioned elsewhere as well, but it is specifically mentioned in the context. Supply chain is specifically mentioned in the context of NS2 compliance. And NS2, of course, is the Cybersecurity Act. I can't remember the full name. It's just NIS2 to me.
No, the Cybersecurity Act is a separate act. And NIS2 is the Information Systems Act, I believe.
Systems Act.
But almost nobody knows. So NIS2 is a piece of legislation that takes care of organizational security measures. So it says that if you are running, I can't recall what the exact terminology is. Is it essential or important or critical? All three of those words are used somehow in the act.
I think they are actually used to structure some of the requirements.
Yeah, I think the way it works is that you have important and critical are two categories.
Yeah, that's usually how
it works.
And then
essential is a combination of the two. There's something like that. But basically, when you are an organization that's on this list in the annex of NIS2, then you are in scope of NIS2, and you need to demonstrate that you do certain things to protect the cybersecurity of your organization.
These are institutions like, or I should say companies like social media platforms or network, IXPs, things like that. They are, a lot of it is internet infrastructure,
yeah,
I think would
also
be another way of just
with NIS2, the scope got quite a bit broadened. And again, I'm not an NIS2 expert, but a lot of manufacturing companies, etc., are also in scope of NIS2. And one of the obligations that's in NIS2 is that you need to be in control of the upstream part of the supply chain of things that you buy. So when you buy a firewall, you need to actually check that firewall is sufficiently secure for the application that you're using it for, which is basically the same obligation as the component due diligence.
It's not entirely clear to me how those are linked.
But to me,
I will say it is reasonably clear.
I'm not sure how they're.
Yeah, I'm just not quite sure how they snap together, the Lego model.
So NIS2 says that when you're an organization and you're running a network and information system, then you need to make sure that you operate it in a secure way. And part of that is you need to use secure products and infrastructure to run that. And the CRA is the thing that tells manufacturer that they actually need to build secure products. So it works together in two ways, where the CRA, it makes sure that there are sufficiently secure products available for the NIS2 entities to buy, But then also it gives an IS2 entity something that they can check for, where if a product is CRA compliant, then that already gives some level of assurance as to the cybersecurity of that product. Of course, depending on what type of entity you are and where you're using that product, you might need to check additional things. But should we get to the hot of the press take that we got from
Let's do this. Is our hot take.
So August is the one today that noticed it, so he gets to go.
My hot take is this, that the CRA, when it talks about these supply chain obligations and relates them to NIS2, mentions that the cybersecurity risk to supply chain also needs to consider non-technical aspects. And the more you read into this and the more you look at, the more you look into it, the more you see this is a technical sovereignty claim that if you are sourcing products from not just someone shady, but somewhere that potentially, some country that is potentially not behaving well on the internet. That's a paraphrase, literally. Let me see if I can find it.
If I can jump in for a second, because you said it was about supply chain, but I formulated even a bit stronger, and that is that the CRA says that you are not allowed to sell insecure products on the EU market. In a nutshell, that's what the CRA says. Right? And then there is this, we first found it in the recital, but it's also mentioned elsewhere in the law. But the recital 58, first, it gives a number of potential non-technical risk factors. So where is the manufacturer based? How is the ownership structure? What kind of legislation is applicable where the manufacturer is based? And then it explicitly says that when considering whether a product is insecure, which basically means whether considering whether a product is non-CRA compliant, the market surveillance authorities, they should, it doesn't even say can, right? It says they should consider those non-technical risk factors. And if those non-technical risk factors lead to an MSA concluding that the product is insecure, that means that product can no longer be sold in Europe.
I think it goes beyond that, because there's another section on compliant products, CRA compliant products that fall afoul of this concern, which is that under NIS2, ANISA can take these union-wide kind of assessments of products that they find insecure for security reasons. And even if that product is C-marked, it's gone through, you've done nothing wrong as the manufacturer, if they find that issue is there with this imported product maybe, or this component within your product, ANISA, rather than the local MSA, can perform its own assessments, is my understanding, under NIS2. And then that can flow into a CRA assessment, or not assessment, I should say, a CRA action by EU authorities that can pull the product off the market, even if it's compliant. Obviously, this needs some more time to think about, but it's potentially a huge and likely very rare thing. The other thing I think that's particularly notable is the phrase irresponsible behavior in cyberspace, because that's pretty broad. That could be anything, really, right? What does irresponsible behavior in cyberspace by a nation state mean?
What even is cyberspace?
They can't use the word internet under EU law because it has so many different meanings. But so cyberspace, I don't know. I feel like it makes me want to surf the web in cyberspace, but I just feel old.
Right. On that note that you're feeling old, should we finish up for this episode?
Yeah, I think we should, because I got to go surf the web.
Yeah. No. So I think I got to go. This notion that a product might be non-CRA compliant because of where it's manufactured and by whom it's manufactured, I think that's very interesting. We just noticed it before we started recording this episode, and we found it super interesting because we've never heard someone talk about it before. But I think it's definitely a topic that deserves more attention, and maybe we'll come back to this in some later episode.
Maybe we can find someone who's an expert on technical sovereignty to talk to about it.
That would be cool. Anyway.
Yeah. All right.
August, nice talking to you.
Yeah, nice talking to you. I think I'm going to go look for some web browser games to play, maybe some little quick JavaScript things. Yeah, it'll be fun. I'm just go regress back to 1999.
Yeah, let's do that. And whether or not those JavaScript games are something that falls under the CRA or not, actually also something that's currently...
Well, but I mean, it's a web service, so
it might be more complicated than that. I agree. It's probably a web service.
This is a next topic. Next time we should talk about RDPS.
All right. See you, August.
All right. See you, Pete.